It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. A new study shows that not exercising is bad for us. How bad? Maybe as bad as smoking or diabetes. We'll talk with the lead author coming up. First, the pool of high school graduates in Wisconsin is shrinking. The smaller pool puts the state's colleges and universities at a disadvantage as there are fewer in-state students to recruit and competition is high. Our next guest took a look at the factors behind the smaller graduating classes and what colleges and universities in Wisconsin are doing to close that gap. Kelly Meyerhofer covers higher education at the Wisconsin State Journal. Kelly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, give us some of the scope of the problem here. How much is this pool of high school graduates shrinking in Wisconsin?
Sure. Administrators in colleges across the state have been talking about the declining number of high school graduates for a while now. But I decided to see, you know, when this dip is going to start to go back up. And what I found when I looked at this report from the UW-Madison Applied Population Lab is that next year's graduating class of seniors in both public and private schools is going to be the smallest pool that the state has seen in years, probably since about 2000. The numbers are projected to go up after that. So this next year's class will be the smallest, though. And those seniors are now in their junior year, which is when the college recruitment season typically begins.
Now, this is, we don't need to dig in the reasons behind it, but this is just sheer demographics, just by, for a variety of reasons, 17, 18 years ago, fewer kids were born, and now we're seeing the consequences of that in these high school graduating classes?
Yes, that's right. The report's authors didn't really get into why they think that next year's class is so low. I mean, I think the dot-com bust in the early 2000s might have something to do with it. During the Great Recession, the 2008 era, there was also another dip in students. So that group won't be entering college until like 2026, around there. And that's another period that colleges will see enrollment contract.
Now, almost all schools, and we're talking UW system schools on the public side and private schools you looked at, almost all schools are struggling with this as a problem. One exception we'll get out of the way first. UW-Madison doesn't seem to be as affected, you write. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, as the state's flagship university, they sort of have a different they face different challenges. They're recruiting a lot more out-of-state students, international students. A lot of their competitors are those peers within the Big Ten and other large schools. They're a Research One institution where a lot of, you know, the UW smaller schools are not Research One institutions. So it's just sort of different challenges that UW-Madison faces.
Then let's turn to the rest of the UW system. Can you talk about what they're facing, some of the other campuses, and some of the tactics they're trying to use to bring students in?
Sure. I think one of the things that stood out to me in my reporting was when I talked to UW Oshkosh Chancellor Andrew Leavitt. He said, you know, we're not going to grow our way out of this because there's so many great institutions in the state of Wisconsin. So colleges have really had to try to find different ways to reach students, especially since students these days are a lot more digitally savvy, you know, direct mailers, stuff like that. Colleges are still doing that, but they've found it not to be as effective. The UW system has created this mobile app that students can download on their phone where they can enter, you know, what they might want their major to be, how far away they want to go to school, what size campus they're looking at. And then the app's algorithm sort of spits out what fit would be the best for them among the UW schools. And they've had nearly 9,000 students download the app. It was created in the summer of 2017. So I thought that was an interesting strategy to try to reach students where they are.
Talking to Kelly Meyerhofer from the Wisconsin State Journal. She covers higher education there, talking about a challenge facing most public and private universities and colleges in the state. Fewer students graduating from high school. There just aren't as many of them. That's creating some financial challenges. And Kelly, let's talk about that. A lot of schools are dependent in large part on that tuition money to pay the bills, right? This is a financial challenge, not just a recruitment challenge.
Right. It definitely has created a financial challenge. The state's funding to the UW system has decreased over the years, which means schools are a lot more reliant on tuition dollars. So when there's fewer students, they have less money coming in. And we've already seen that across a variety of UW schools that have adapted to those financial challenges. A couple weeks ago, I reported UW Oshkosh next academic year will be asking faculty within the College of Letters and Sciences to increase their faculty workload so that some adjunct professors can be not used because more faculty will be teaching additional courses.
Now, UW-Green Bay, you wrote, took advantage of its proximity to the Green Bay Packers to kind of have a sports-themed draft party to get students excited. What happened there?
Yeah, UW-Green Bay was an interesting case study when I did my reporting. They're one of the smaller UW schools, but they're in a pretty large metro area, and they've seen their enrollment grow over the past 4 years despite these overall demographic trends. Last spring, they had this event at Lambeau Field in partnership with some local high schools to try to get more students thinking about going to college. Traditionally, the data has showed about a third of Wisconsin high school students enroll in a UW institution, and they want to grow the number that choose to go on to college. So this event was kind of a sports-themed thing at Lambeau Field. They went through booths and drills. Training camp was where they learned about campus living and dining. A table on studying abroad was called the Away Game. And then at the end of the day, students signed a letter of intent promising to commit to college, and Packers kicker Mason Crosby joined them for that letter signing.
And now this isn't just a UW story. You also talk to people from Viterbo, Ripon, and other private colleges around the state. What kind of things did you hear there?
Yeah, there was a lot of private schools that, you know, they're trying to find a way through this as well, and a lot of them have really tried to personalize the college search process. I thought it was really interesting at Ripon College. The president sends handwritten notes to each accepted student, and because it's a pretty small school, there's less than 1,000 students total. It's not too labor-intensive, but, you know, the president said that, you know, they think that it sends a message to prospective students that, you know, that the student comes first, and that's something that they really pride themselves on. At Carthage, they have like a postcard that has students' names sort of spray painted on this campus landmark. And Viterbo is just trying to do a lot more personalization and things online. So across the state, colleges are trying to find ways to adapt to these changing demographics.
Getting back to the UW system, there's a big question mark here. There's this UW restructuring where the two-year campuses are being partnered up with the four-year campuses. What are people watching for there? Obviously, we don't know how that's going to play out in terms of student enrollment, but what are people watching for there?
Yeah, I mean, one of the ways that that colleges have thought that they could adjust to the declining number of students graduating from high school is looking at adult learners and growing that population. At the two-year campuses that are now joining the four-year campuses, that'll open up some new opportunities, administrators say, in growing that adult population of students.
As you talked to leaders of campuses, public and private around the state, does it feel like this is a crisis and they're panicking, or is this, okay, this is a low point, we just got to weather the storm for a few years, and then we're going to have a demographic boost, we're going to see more students?
Well, if you look at the projections, I mean, next academic year will be the lowest, and their colleges have already, you know, they've been analyzing these numbers for years, so they knew it was coming and they've adjusted to it. What I'm really interested in seeing is when all of the small pool of babies that were born during the Great Recession, when they hit the college age 18 years from now, that'll be like 2026-ish, what colleges will be looking at during that sort of enrollment contraction, because that'll be an even bigger drop than the one that we'll be seeing next year.
We'll leave it there for now. Kelly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rob. Appreciate it.
Kelly Meyerhofer covers higher education at the Wisconsin State Journal. She joined us today to talk about the shrinking pool of high school graduates in the state and the impact that's having on Wisconsin's colleges and universities. We know that most of us could use more exercise. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says only 23% of Americans get enough exercise. Well, some new research might motivate you to get moving. It says being less fit could pose a greater threat to our health than smoking, diabetes, or heart disease. Also showed that better cardiorespiratory fitness was linked to living longer. Dr. Wael Jaber is a cardiologist at Cleveland Clinic and the lead author of the exercise study. Dr. Jaber, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Thanks for taking the time.
Well, take us through your basic findings. How bad is not being fit going to be for our long-term health?
So this is a good question. What we looked at a 25-year period where we had patients or individuals sent to our institution at the Cleveland Clinic for a stress test, basically a routine treadmill stress test that most of us are familiar with. And we looked at the long-term outcome of these patients or these individuals based on how long they can last on the treadmill. And, of course, we adjust this to their gender and age and other factors. And what we found out is if you divide the group into five groups, which is the lowest fitness group, all those patients got on the treadmill. So we have a lowest fitness group versus the highest fitness group. You can find out that the patients who have the highest fitness are five times less likely to have to die on follow-up than patients who are the least fit in the group. I'll give you just an example to compare that with what you mentioned earlier of smoking, diabetes, hypertension, all the known risk factors for heart disease. So if you're a smoker in our group, your risk of having of dying is about 40% higher than non-smoker. But if you are in the lowest fitness group, your risk of dying is 500% higher. So 40% versus 500%. Of course, this is not a license for people to go out and smoke, but this tells you just the magnitude of the risk from being less fit compared to other traditional risk factors.
We know that with smoking, we can at least hopefully manage that problem by quitting smoking. Easier said than done, I know. How much control do we have when it comes to things like exercise over our fitness? How much could someone improve their performance, say, on that stress test by exercising regularly?
So it depends also when you start. This is probably the $64,000 question. Depends where you start and when you start in your life. So we saw from our study that the magnitude of benefit is actually most in the elderly, in patients who are above the age of 70. So that means it's almost like a retirement plan where the more you deposit in this, the more you're going to benefit from this because it's very unlikely you're going to be very fit after the age of 70 if you were not fit all your life. So I would say without data probably from our study, because we didn't look at that specifically, that the earlier you start probably is the better. The more you continue this throughout your life is better for you, and the more you keep it later on in life, you keep or you stay fit, the better it is for you. Of course, there are genetic factors we didn't study. There are socioeconomic factors we didn't study. If you live in a community that has sidewalks, allows you to go out, walk around safely, is different than living from a rural place where you don't have these facilities. So all these play a role, but in general, being fit at any age is best for you, and being fit as you get older is best.
I think a lot of times people think of exercise, in America anyway, as a weight loss technique, a weight management technique, and we might think of fitness as has something to do with our weight and our BMI. Is there a benefit to fitness just completely apart from what it does for our weight?
This group, actually, if you look at our study, all these patients and all these fitness groups had the same body weight. So, and that's surprising for us because we thought that probably the less fit patients or the less fit individuals will have a higher body mass index or higher weight. That wasn't the case. These were all in the same range as far as body mass index. So this is independent of how much you control your weight or independent of how much you control your other risk factors. This is additional benefit of just purely derived from fitness.
And on the other end of things, some studies in the past have suggested links between extreme exercise and bad cardiovascular outcomes. When you looked at the most fit people, is there such a thing, I guess, as being too fit?
So there is a difference between extreme exercise and extreme fitness on the treadmill, and that's some of the criticism we received when we published the study, is individuals start sending me emails saying, you know, I run 5 hours a day and go to the gym 2 hours later. So that's not what we looked at. So if you look at the elite group in each age group we have, you can find that there was no J-curve or what we call J-curve in medicine, which basically you can increase harm as you get more fit, which was suggested from prior studies. So that we didn't see. Now, we did not measure how much people are exercising at home, or we did not measure what people do in their daily activities. We did not look at that. We just looked purely of objectively how far they can go on a treadmill.
Talking to Dr. Wael Jaber, cardiologist at Cleveland Clinic, lead author of a study on fitness and the difference that it can make being unfit versus being very fit in your long-term health outcomes, long-term risk of death in earlier years. Dr. Jaber, what are you hoping that, first of all, the medical community takes away from this? How could this inform doctors' communication with their patients about fitness?
This is the public health message that we can probably propagate from this study. First, there is a definite association between fitness and mortality. The second question, this is a very simple test. This doesn't require high-tech equipment, does not require too much expenditures in healthcare to figure out who's fit and who's not fit. And hopefully when you go to see your doctor or when I go to see my doctor, the question should not be asked whether the test is normal or abnormal when they put me on a treadmill. The question should be asked, how do I compare to my group, to my cohort, my age match and gender match cohort, and figure out where do I fit in this group? Do I fit in the lowest end or I fit in the highest end? And then get from your physician or from your provider an idea of how you can improve this. And there is something called exercise prescription, actually, that is covered by most insurances, where you can actually go meet with an exercise physiologist in a medical facility and get a prescription to improve your fitness. So if you get that message out, which is fitness is important for your overall mortality, and two, you can modify it, and three, there is a prescription for that that probably will work better than a lot of medications we take.
Now, I mentioned extreme exercise early. I'm going to say probably for the overwhelming majority of Americans, extreme exercise isn't the problem we have to worry about. It's not enough exercise. Do we have a basic health problem of too sedentary a lifestyle in this country?
So you started your segment with stating the statistics from the CDC, and I think this is getting worse. We have studies now, multiple studies showing when they put pedometers on even kids in school, showing that there is a definite decline in the number of steps these kids take per day, and that's related to multiple things. One of them is probably the access to technology. We have engineered, we have probably succeeded in engineering activity completely out of our life over the past 3-4 decades. And that's going to lead to less fitness on all levels. And unfortunately, right now, it's starting early in life. It's not after you get your first job and you get your office job and you sit down in a chair and start pushing papers. It's probably much, much earlier, and starting right now with toddlers, when you see them sitting around playing on their phones and rather than engaging in physical activity. That's the problem is not going to go away. Probably it's going to get worse.
Yeah, you've mentioned a couple times things that aren't individual problems. You know, you personally need to get more exercise, or even a doctor-patient problem. These are, it sounds like, in part, public health problems. If we have neighborhoods that aren't conducive to walking, if we have jobs that aren't conducive to exercise that lead to a sedentary lifestyle, do we need to be thinking about this as a public health problem?
I just want to take the time to just put this in perspective. If I go and I have health insurance plan, and my health insurance plan doesn't allow me to buy a blood pressure medication to treat my hypertension, there would be probably people would be up in arms about that, saying you're not giving me the medication that I need to save my life. And the same thing probably applies to cholesterol medications and other medications. But if a community decides to, if you decide to build a community without sidewalks, if you decide to build a community that doesn't allow people to casually walk around, commingle, go to your next door neighbor without actually driving in the car, nobody would think about it as a public health issue or something that's endangering our life. I think as I told a couple of people who interviewed me about this, is one of the things you can demand from your elected officials is to create communities that are conducive to longevity, meaning conducive to a healthy life, conducive to physical activity, because that's probably one thing we can work on as a community rather than as individuals.
Do you think that idea is starting to catch on among your fellow physicians and maybe beyond?
The physician community for in general has been trained to deal with disease, not with a lot of prevention. So that actually has to be consumer driven, like most things. So a lot of people demand. I was listening to your show when I was waiting on to get on with you. People demanding organic food. People demanding cleaner water. People demanding things that less pesticides in their products. But probably that has to come from society. It's not going to be driven mostly by physicians, because we trained to treat disease, not to prevent disease.
We'll leave it there. Dr. Jaber, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. This is an honor.
Dr. Wael Jaber is a cardiologist at Cleveland Clinic. We talked with him about a study he led that showed that poor fitness is a major health risk, on a par potentially with smoking, diabetes, or heart disease. You can share your thoughts on this, by the way. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. Do you think your community is set up in a way that allows people to get out and be fit, to not be sedentary? How about your workplace? Tweet us at Central Time WPR. It's Food Friday. Cooking for yourself doesn't have to mean eating the leftovers of the same meal every day all week. It also doesn't have to be a chore. The author of a new cookbook says cooking for one can be an opportunity to take good care of ourselves. Anita Lowe has been named one of the 10 best new chefs in America by Food & Wine magazine. She owned and operated the New York-based restaurant Anissa until 2017. She's the author of the new cookbook called Solo, a modern cookbook for a party of one. Anita, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Well, I think a lot of us have been here, either if I lived alone or when my family's not around, I'm used to cooking for them. And I'm thinking, why go to the trouble of cooking if I'm the only one who's eating that food? Can you talk us out of that attitude?
Well, I mean, I think it's cheaper to eat at home, first of all. It's also healthier. I think studies have been shown that instead of, you know, going and getting that burrito or, you know, some fast food, once you start cooking at home and buying real ingredients, you're already, you know, 50% of the way there. And it can be fun, and then you can eat exactly what you want.
Yeah, my inner turmoil wasn't always go out to eat versus stay in, but sort of a half-hearted effort, you know, peanut butter sandwich again. Why not? It's just me. But we can actually do something fun and compelling all by ourselves when we're cooking for one.
Absolutely, and it doesn't have to be complicated. I mean, you can do something that's, you know, almost as easy as a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. You know, boil some pasta, throw some tomatoes on that, and some Calabrian chili. Delicious.
And a big part of your book is also another worry that I have, how to not be wasteful. Because I worry, oh, if I buy this whole thing of whatever fresh herb or, you know, a big chunk of meat or whatever, oh, I'm going to waste like half of it because I only need a little bit. So how do we be mindful of how to do those serving sizes for one but not waste all the stuff?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of tips in my book for that. Herbs are hard. I mean, I think you need to sort of grow your own. I do have tips, or you can, you know, there's usually recipes for to be able to use up everything. And there's a little don't waste it section for each recipe. Like if I only require like a half of an avocado in a recipe, I'll direct you to another recipe that uses up that other half.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's, I mean, you know, you do need to, you know, I suggest getting a weight scale and weighing out your ingredients so you know exactly, you know, instead of eyeballing a thing of pasta, you know, 4 ounces is standard, weigh that out. And then you're not going to have too much.
And
there's a lot of different things you can do.
And a common theme in your book, as I go from recipe to recipe, is that kind of premeditation, like you were talking about with the avocado there. You know, thinking in advance, when you have time on that night alone, doing a lot of the groundwork so that when you need something quick in a few days or next week or whatever, you pull something out and you're ready to rock.
Oh, yeah. There's a couple of recipes like that that are sort of longer recipes, but then they're several, you know, you can freeze them and then it lasts for a long time and it'll take, you know, no more than 5-10 minutes to bring up for dinner.
Talking to Chef Anita Lowe, her new book is called Solo, A Modern Cookbook for a Party of One. Well, speaking of recipes that reward that early investment, one of the ones you've shared with us, we have it up at WPR.org/Food Friday, is a pork and garlic chive dumpling. So you say it could take an evening to get it done, but then it freezes really good.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and then all you have to do is take it out and cook it from the frozen state. And, you know, dumplings are great because they've got your meat, they've got your vegetable, they've got your starch. It's a healthy meal.
So talk about the filling for this pork and garlic chive dumpling. What all is going in there?
Well, you know, there's variations on that theme that go on forever. But I think the one that I did was just ground pork. I think there's a little bit of shrimp in there, but you could leave that out. Some garlic chives, which are these flat Chinese chives. Those are also optional if you can't find them. Scallions, soy sauce, a little bit of sugar. I think that's it. And then you just wrap them in, you know, some store-bought wrappers. And it's, you know, it's sort of a nice meditative experience, for me at least. And I don't know. It certainly an investment in your future.
And I'm a little intimidated by the dumpling wrapping concept because, I mean, even going back to elementary school, folding and cutting and pasting, I was never good at. Is this something with a little practice we can really get on a roll?
Oh, absolutely. The thing is, does it matter what they look like? No.
Because it's just you.
Yeah, no one else is going to look at them. And, you know, if you really just want to fold them in half and glue them together, that's fine.
All right, we've got that recipe at WPR.org/Food Friday. Okay, one recipe in the book. We don't have this up, but I wanted to bring it up. A lot of your recipes are about embracing the joys in some ways of being alone. But you've got one that rolls with, you know, when you're in a bad mood about being alone. This is the name of the recipe. A single broken egg on a bed of torn, wilted, bitter greens with blue cheese. Talk about that one.
Well, you know, I think since I was the chef of Maxime's, which was way back when, you know, every Valentine's Day we had to do a special menu. And, it was always such a cheesy holiday, you know, for me. We did hearts and pink things and red things. And I always thought it was important to do something for the lonely person. And so every year I would do, I just got cheesier and cheesier as it went on. And we did a lot of plays on words like that. And I think my first one was a monkfish, you know, monk with on something. I don't remember. It had clams on it as well. But yeah, it's been fun to come up with.
Yeah, and I love you've got the greens. It sounds really good, actually. The cheese, the egg, some prunes, a lot of fresh herbs, and the last ingredient, a healthy dose of self-pity.
Well, there you go. The most important one. It's okay to mourn.
Well, let's get to another recipe that we have shared. Actually, let's stick with that that egg theme. This is, check me on the pronouncer here, a yokodon with dashi. Translates as parent and child over rice. Talk
yes.
about this one.
Well, it's oyakodon. Don is sort of a rice bowl. And oyako, I don't remember. Anyway, so it's basically like some chicken thighs. I like the thighs braised in dashi with a little egg stirred in at the end.
So that's the chicken and the egg. That's the parent and child part.
Yeah, which came first? Yeah.
And dashi is not a household name, I think, in Wisconsin cooking. What is that and what do we do with it?
It is the easiest stock to prepare. It's easier than making chicken stock. It's easier than anything. It's got three ingredients, water, bonito flakes, and kombu, which is a seaweed. It's a kelp. And you can buy the last two online, you know, or I'm sure you can buy them at your health food store. But it takes, you know, if you wanted to, you could do it in 5 minutes.
And this one, the egg goes on, I think you mentioned, at the last moment, and it you put it over the hot rice and stuff, and it just sets like that. This is a pretty common thing, I understand, in Japanese cooking. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, this is a pretty classic Japanese dish.
And getting away from the solo part of your book, you are a big fan of merging foods from a lot of different traditions, right?
Well, yeah, I don't believe that, food has borders. I think I think culture is mutable and food is constantly changing. You know, cuisines, definitions of cuisines are changing. Yeah, it's like language.
And you're a fellow native of southeastern Michigan, if I'm not mistaken. You are. Some of your recipes seem like they're inspired by a lot of the Middle Eastern cooking that shows up in the greater Detroit area.
Yes, exactly. yes, my girlfriend's dad is also Lebanese. So,
a lot of good stuff out of that. We're talking to Chef Anita Lowe. Her new cookbook is called Solo, A Modern Cookbook for a Party of One. And you can join in at 800-642-1234, whether or not you live alone. What are some of your favorite things to make for yourself? Do you enjoy cooking for yourself, or does it feel like a chore to go through a whole recipe for just one person, and that one person's you? Or do you love that opportunity? Like, I like to make some things that I know my family doesn't make. The beets come out, for example, when I'm the only one eating it. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. Right now, we're picking up our Food Friday conversation with Anita Lowe, chef and author of the new cookbook, Solo, A Modern Cookbook for a Party of One. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you cook for yourself all the time and only yourself all the time, or maybe sometimes when the rest of the family is out? Does it seem like a chore, a bother to you, or do you love the opportunity? If you're consistently cooking for yourself, have you figured out some tips, some ideas to keep it fun and not too much work? Or do you have a question for our guest? She cooks lots of different stuff. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Garrett is with us in McFarland. Garrett, hi.
Hi there. Hi. Well, there's a dish that I bring out that my mom used to make for me when I was a kid. No one else would eat it but her and I, and it was oyster soup.
Uh-huh.
But it went together so quickly. I mean, it was literally whole milk, two cans of oysters, some diced potatoes, butter, salt, and pepper. I mean, it goes so fast, and it's so flavorful, so delicious. Over the years, I've kind of ramped it up and done different things to make it a bit more elegant than just canned things. But it's just something, once people taste it, the thought of it, they don't like it. But once I can finally get a spoonful in them, they're like, oh, my God, this is delicious.
And, Garrett, do you look forward to chances when you know it's just you eating tonight and, okay, I'm making this oyster soup, I don't care what anybody says?
Oh, yeah, the lights go down. It's on. I'm all by myself.
All right. Garrett, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. I'd try it if you put it in front of me. The oysters aren't at the top of my radar. Do you have anything like that, Anita, something that maybe goes back to your childhood that you are looking forward to the chance to make for yourself?
gosh, you know, there's the embarrassing things like Kraft macaroni and cheese, which isn't really a recipe per se, but... Yeah, you know, I make my mom's steamed fish quite often.
Steamed fish. And what kind of fish do you use for that? So, or I guess depending what's available.
Yeah, depending. Yeah, what's available and what looks best at the market.
Garrett.
It's always good to deal with that once you get there.
And staying with the soup theme, that's a great thing to make for yourself because, you know, you make as much as you want and then freeze whatever you're not going to eat in the next couple of days. Do you have any favorite soups to recommend from the cookbook?
I don't think there's any other soups. Oh, there's a noodle soup in there.
Right, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, there's a Korean beef and kimchi noodle soup that I like a lot. But that is, I made that for one. But yeah, no, I love making like big pots of soup and keeping, you know, containers in the freezer.
We've got another recipe you shared with us up at WPR.org/Food Friday. This is a steamed artichoke with lemon and herb butter. And I got to say, I grew up not eating artichokes. So when I encountered them, it seemed like, oh, this is a special fancy meal, big production kind of food. It's simpler than I think.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, you just have to boil it.
I love artichokes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, nothing better.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, you don't even have to make like a fancy butter. Just use the butter. Or like in France, just, you know, get it cold and use your favorite vinaigrette.
And it's a lemon and herb butter that you have in this recipe. I'm just stirring lemon and fresh herbs and butter and that's it?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
And- And for people who are unfamiliar with the artichoke, because again, the first time I encountered one, you know, a whole artichoke on my plate, I was like, what the heck do I do with this? What's the part you eat? Talk us through the eating of an artichoke.
Well, you know, it's a bud of this thistle, and it's got little leaves on the side, and you pull off a leaf, and at the base of the part that attaches to the flower, there is some meat, and you want to just scrape that off with the bottom of your teeth. And it's really delicious. And then once you get down to the center, there's the choke. There's a little hairy part that you don't want to eat, hence the word choke. And you scoop that out and discard it. And then you've got a heart, which is like the best part because it's just a lot of that same meat that you've been pulling off with your teeth, only it's in like a big chunk. And that, you know, I usually like to put a little bit of salt on that because even if your water is really salted, it doesn't always make it to the core, and then dip it in whatever you're dipping it in and eat it. It's fantastic.
Talking to Anita Lowe, author of the new book, Solo, a modern cookbook for a party of one. She says, hey, even if you're just cooking for yourself, you can still have fun with it and make a great meal. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences cooking for a party of one, you, and what some of your favorite things are to cook when you're cooking just for yourself. 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Anita, sprinkled through the book, you've got some basic tips on how to make some of these core basic things. And some people I know have trouble with like white rice. It's easy to get it too dry or too goopy. Do you have some tips to make sure we get it right every time?
You have to measure it. Like, use like a measuring cup. It's usually one part rice to 1.5 parts water. So the general rule of thumb is a half a cup of rice per serving, if that's sort of the main part of your dish. And so if you're using half a cup of rice, you use 0.75 cups of water.
Now, is that white rice? Because I'm great with cooking white rice. Brown rice, it never comes out exactly the way I want it.
Oh, it takes a little bit longer, and maybe you add just a little bit more water. Maybe another tablespoon of water to that, it should be fine.
Oh, so that fiber kind of soaks up the extra water for us there.
Yeah, and then you just bring it to a boil, stir. I'd like to, especially the white rice, you need to rinse a couple times, and then drain, and then measure out the water that you put in. Cook it, bring it to a boil, cover it, turn the heat as low as it goes, and just wait, 20 minutes for white rice, maybe 25, 30 minutes for brown rice.
And it's fall here in Wisconsin. There's a lot of great food, I imagine. In New York, there is too. What kind of seasonal ingredients have you excited, whether you're cooking for one or more than one right about now?
Oh, well, Concord grapes are fantastic right now. I love them. Yeah, there's a lot of great pumpkins that are coming out. Although this year there's been too much rain, so they're not as dense. Yes, it's fall. It's all sorts of squash season. Beets are fantastic. All the root vegetables. Potatoes coming out of the ground right now. Delicious. New potatoes. Yum.
And we are just past Halloween, of course, and that means we're going to start thinking about pies for Thanksgiving and beyond. And you've got a few pie recipes. Now, I got to say, I try to avoid making or buying a pie if I know I'm the only one who's going to eat it, because I will eat it all. Is it? You've got some solo pie recipes in here. What are good ones to make for ourselves?
You know, I think if you make a crumble, a crumb topping, which is pretty standard. You can keep that in your refrigerator or your freezer for quite some time. And then you can make little individual fruit crumbles with whatever fruit is in season. That's great. And that actually also, if you roll it out, you could use that like a pie crust.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. And I didn't look closely at the pies, I will admit. Do you go for like hand pies when you're making things for yourself?
I used a little mold that I had. It was just like a little individual tart mold, which you can buy. I'm pretty sure you can buy that, Bed Bath & Beyond anywhere.
Now, how about what's a good late night? You've been out, either you work late or you've been out with friends, doing whatever with friends. What are some of your late night solo cooking quick go-tos?
Ooh, pasta. Yeah, pasta is always fun. I was talking about that pasta recipe. I have, I have a couple of recipes where you just take dried pasta because it's there. Usually you have it in your cabinet. And there's one with Calabrian chilies and grape tomatoes or cherry tomatoes that I particularly like. I think there's one with charred lemons. That's in that book. What's not in the book is just sort of oil with oil and butter and garlic and pepper. Yeah, cacio e pepe is you just have that. It's just cheese and pepper and goodness.
We've got a tweet from a listener, Karen, who tweeted a picture of her son's weeknight dinner for himself. I don't have a description of it. I'm going to say it's like little pork medallions, mashed potatoes. I'm looking at some greens. You can look at it yourself at Central Time WPR on Twitter. Do you, when you're cooking for yourself, Anita, does visual presentation matter to you? It does to Karen's son, apparently. It doesn't to me. How about you?
Yeah, it does, but it's because I've been trained that way. Yeah, 30 years in the business, this is how it's done.
Well, and that's what I wonder as I'm reading this whole book. When you come up, you cook all darn day. You've been doing this for 30 years professionally. Does it ever feel like work when you're cooking for yourself, or is it still fun just to cook at home?
I think it's fun to cook at home, but, when I'm in New York City, I don't cook so much. But when I'm out in Long Island, I cook a lot more because I have a much bigger kitchen there. Yeah, and if I've been working all day, if I did my 12 to 14 hour days, which is standard in the restaurant business, no, I'm not cooking for myself when I come home.
And sometimes maybe just a doggy bag from the restaurant you've been cooking at all day.
Exactly. Or, that's not true. Sometimes I'll make a salad.
Not bad. But, Anita, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you for having me.
I've been talking to Chef Anita Lowe. She joined us to talk about our new cookbook. It's called Solo, a modern cookbook for a party of one. Still time for you to let us know about your solo cooking endeavors, whether you steer clear of it, go super easy, or just order in when it's just you, or if you go all out and make yourself, it could be simple, but make yourself a really yummy meal. You can send pictures, too. You can go to the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And, of course, you can always find a lot of recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. From Anita, we have their steamed artichoke with lemon and herb butter, pork and garlic chive dumplings, and the other one. Here it is, oyakodon with, and I don't think I'm pronouncing it right, with dashi, that thing with the egg on top. There's rice. That one looks really good. Check them out, and recipes from past guests as well. It's all online at WPR.org/Food Friday. Try them out. Let us know how it went. The inspiration for one of the most famous names in video game history has passed away this week. Seattle landlord and developer Mario Segale was 84. His last name might not be a household word around the world, but his first name, Mario, is. I didn't know this story. Actually, NPR reported on this. Segale was the landlord of the Nintendo Company's Seattle area offices in the 1970s. Now, the game Donkey Kong had come out, and for American marketing, the company wanted a name for the hero. He was just known as Jumpman in the original Japanese version. That doesn't ring. The landlord, Mario, wore suspenders like the video game character, and so, they borrowed his name and a legend was born. Now, apparently he knew that the character was named after him. I don't think he got any royalties from it, but he never wanted to make a big deal about it. Meanwhile, the video game Mario went on to big things, a long line of Super Mario Brothers games, the Super Mario World and Galaxy, a Mario Kart series. There was a breakfast cereal and a kind of a weird movie with Bob Hoskins. I didn't see it. It was not well reviewed. But the name Mario instead of Jumpman really did catch on and became a part of a lot of childhoods in my, teen years as well. If you're a Mario fan, thank the memory of Mario. The original one, Mario Segale, as you maybe fire up Mario Kart one more time. This is Central Time.